Are you a good communicator? You may have noticed that this skill is not evenly distributed among the population. But imagine how much better your life and career would be if you mastered this superpower. If you were able to effortlessly use words and body language to inspire, influence, and connect. Well, you're in luck, people, because Charles Duhigg is here to share some big ideas from his latest book, Super Communicators: How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Charles is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and the best-selling author of The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. He writes for The New Yorker and other publications and was previously a senior editor at The New York Times. Here he is to share his key insights.
Hi, I'm Charles Duhigg, the author of Super Communicators, which is coming out February 20th. And it is such a pleasure to be here with the Next Big Idea Club for their Book Bites to tell you a little bit about super communicators and some of the ideas at the core of this book. I previously wrote a book called The Power of Habit, as well as one called Smarter, Faster, Better. I'm a reporter at the New Yorker magazine. It was previously at the New York Times. But I want to tell you a little bit about why I started writing Super Communicators. I had this problem that I'm imagining many of you also have, which is sometimes I would come home after a long day at work and I would be in a bad mood. You know, my boss would have been mean to me and I'd start complaining to my wife and telling her all about my woes, you know, that my boss doesn't understand me and that my coworkers don't appreciate me. And I would just start complaining. And she very practically and sensibly and rationally would respond with some good advice. She'd say something like, "Look, you know, why don't you take your boss out to lunch? And that way you guys can get to know each other a little bit better. And hopefully you'll be able to overcome these problems." But instead of hearing her, instead of hearing what she was saying, instead I would get more upset. And I would say things like, "Why aren't you supporting me? You're supposed to be on my side. I want you to be outraged on my behalf." And when I would get upset, she would of course get upset because she's like, "Look, why are you acting so irrational? This is not a hard problem." It was a situation where both of us were trying to have a conversation with each other, both in very well-intentioned trying to have a conversation. And yet for some reason, we just couldn't hear each other. We couldn't connect. And so one of the things I did is I started calling up experts, the communications experts, experts in neurology and psychology, and asking them, what do we actually know about how communication functions? Because it wasn't just with my wife that this would happen. I had recently been made a manager at the New York Times, and you know, I communicate for a living. And I was fine as a manager goes in terms of like logistics, like planning things and coming up with schedules. But the place where I kept on falling down was on communicating with my colleagues. Now, this was weird to me because, again, I communicate for a living. It's something I'm supposed to be good at. And so when I was asking these researchers what's going on, they said, "Well, look, there's a couple of things that you should know that we've learned in the last decade about the science of communication and the science of connection, what language and conversations we can use to connect with other people." Because we're living through this golden age right now, in the past decade, of understanding communication in ways that we never have before. And they said, one of the biggest lessons is that most of us think that when we go into a discussion, that discussion is about one thing. Right, we're going to talk about Jimmy's grades or where we're going on vacation next summer, or I'm just going to tell you about, you know, a funny story that I heard today. And they said, but that's all wrong. Actually, when we have a discussion, we're actually having multiple different kinds of conversations, oftentimes interwoven with each other. And the key is, if you're not having the same kind of conversation as the other person at the same time, you're going to miscommunicate. Now, what I learned is that most conversations fall into one of three big buckets. There are practical conversations, right? Conversations where we talk about setting plans for the future or making decisions together or solving a problem. These are conversations that are sort of about, what's this really about? What are we trying to figure out? But then there's another kind of conversation that we have, the second big bucket, which is that oftentimes when we discuss something, we want to share our emotions. These are emotional conversations. And in those conversations, we don't want our problem to be solved. We don't want to come to some kind of big grand consensus. We just want to explain how we feel, and we want other people to share with us how they feel as well. That's the second kind of conversation, a conversation that's an emotional conversation. How do we feel? And then there's a third big bucket of conversations, which are social conversations. Conversations where we talk about how we relate to other people and how they relate to us, how we see ourselves and how society sees us, how that influences the choices we make and what we feel like is possible and not possible. These three different kinds of conversations, the practical conversation, the emotional conversation, and the social conversation, those make up most of the discussions that we have. And the key is, if you're not having the same kind of conversation as the other person, you're going to miscommunicate. That's exactly what would happen with me and my wife, right? I would come in and I was having an emotional conversation. I was upset. I wanted her to hear how I felt. And she responded with a practical conversation, which was rational and made sense. But because I was in an emotional mindset and she was in a practical mindset, we both failed to hear each other. We failed to connect. This is a really important insight. And in fact, it's so important that oftentimes now in schools, they teach teachers how to use this with a pretty easy thing that I kind of love, which is they say, look, if a student comes up and they have something to tell you and they're upset or they're excited or whatever it is, ask them, do you want me to hear you? Do you want me to help you? Or do you want me to hug you? And these three things, of course, correspond to the three conversations I just mentioned. Hear, help, or hug. In fact, is now my wife and I actually do that with each other. And if I come home and I'm complaining about my day and she'll say, well, look, do you want me to hear you, to help you, or to hug you? I'll say, look, I just want you to hear me. I just want you to listen to like how frustrating this is for me. Or sometimes it can be as simple as saying, do you want me to solve this problem for you, or you just listen to you talk about it, which also sometimes is said. But the point here is that any of us can do this. And once we understand how to recognize the different kinds of conversations that are happening around us, that's when we learn how to become super communicators. Because the truth is, all of us are super communicators at one time or another, right? You have some friend or someone in your life that if you've had a bad day, you know that if you call them, they'll make you feel better. They'll just make you feel like everything's going to be okay. That person for you is a super communicator, and you're probably a super communicator back. And there's been other times that you walk into a meeting and you know exactly what to say to get everyone on your side, and you just kill the meeting. But then there's other times that we really want to connect with someone. We want to have a real conversation with them, and it just doesn't happen. We can't connect with them. The goal of this book, Super Communicators, is to teach people how to be super communicators when they want to be super communicators, because we all have that capacity. We all have the instincts to be super communicators. They're actually part of how evolution has shaped our brain. But once we learn how to use those instincts and those tools to become the super communicators we want to be when we want to, that's when we can have the most meaningful conversations. And so the first big idea is this idea that we're all super communicators, and that the way that we access our instincts and figure out how to connect with someone else is to first of all ask ourselves, what kind of conversation is actually happening? Is this a social conversation, a practical conversation, an emotional conversation? And then match the other person and invite them to match us. Within psychology, this is actually known as the matching principle. And what it says is that we need to be having the same kind of conversation at the same time if we want to connect with each other. Which brings us to the second big idea, which is, so how exactly do we actually do that, right? How do we figure out what kind of conversation is going on here? And what science has found is that there's a pretty easy technique for doing so, which is to ask questions, but a certain kind of question, what's known as a deep question. When we've done studies of people who are super communicators on a regular basis, people who seem to understand something deeply about communication, what's found is that oftentimes these super communicators, they ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as everyone else. But we don't often notice that they're asking these questions because so many of the questions are so easy to hear and respond to. They're questions like, what'd you think of that? Oh, that's interesting. Wait, why do you think that happened? Oh, you know, what happened next? Oh, that's really interesting. Like, what do you think was going on inside his head when he said that? These might seem like kind of throwaway questions, but they're actually deep questions. A deep question is a question that asks us to talk about our values, our beliefs, or our experiences. Because in doing so, we reveal something about who we are to the other person. To us, the person who's asking the question, we learn about whoever we're talking to by asking them a deep question. And deep questions can be really easy to ask. For instance, if someone's a lawyer, you can say, "Oh, you know, you're a lawyer. So did you always want to practice the law? When did you decide to go to law school? Do you love your job?" All three of those are deep questions, and they don't seem overly intimate or probing or inappropriate, but what they do is they invite the other person to talk about what matters to them most, right? To discuss how they decided to become a lawyer, how they saw their dad be impacted by the justice system and they wanted to fight for people like him, how they love their job because they love helping people or they love their colleagues. That simple question, that deep question, is a way to invite someone else to tell you what matters to them, and more importantly, to tell you what kind of conversation they want to have. Because one of the things that we know is that when we answer that question, we tend to answer a question like that, a deep question, either with a practical mindset or an emotional mindset or a social mindset. We can say something like, "You know, I decided to become a lawyer because I just love the law so much and I love helping people. And it's really meaningful to me when someone tells me that I've taken a problem and made it better for them." That's an emotional conversation, right? That person is saying to you, "I want to talk about what our emotions are around our work." On the other hand, someone might say, "I decided to become a lawyer because, you know, I was looking for a good job and I wanted something where I knew I could be home, you know, to help raise the kids. And I think the law is really interesting. Like I like reading contracts. I like writing contracts." That's a practical conversation. Or maybe they say something like, "You know, I saw all these other people getting hurt by the system. I saw that the system could mow down the poor or the dispossessed, and I wanted to go out there and fight on their behalf." That's a social conversation. When we ask a deep question, what someone says back to us not only tells us who they are and what they care about most, they tell us what kind of conversation they want to have. And then we can match them, and we can invite them to match us. We can tell them about our own experiences and our own values and our own beliefs. We can signal whether we want to talk about an emotional discussion or a practical or a social conversation. And we can invite them to align with us to achieve what's known within neurology as neural entrainment, when our brains begin to look alike. And as a result, we really understand what the other person is saying. So this is the second big idea, is ask deep questions. A deep question is something that asks someone to talk about their values or their beliefs or their experiences. And it can be as simple as someone telling you about something and then just saying, "Oh, that's interesting. What's that mean to you? Like, why was that important to you?" That's an easy question, and it's deep. Which brings us to the third idea, which is oftentimes when we're talking to someone, what we really need to do is listen as closely to their non-linguistic communication as the words coming out of their mouth. To tell you about this, I want to tell you a story about in the 1980s, NASA had a basic problem, which is they needed to start choosing different kinds of astronauts. Up until then, most space missions were very, very short, usually just a couple of days at most. But President Ronald Reagan said that he wanted to build a space station where people could go up and live in it for 6 months to a year. And for NASA, this meant we need a different kind of astronaut, because we need someone who, if they're going to live in this tin can surrounded by a vacuum for 6 months or a year with other people, they need to be pretty good at connecting. They need to have a high emotional IQ. They need to know how to get along with people and to listen to their emotions and share their own emotions. They needed people who were good at understanding what kind of conversation was happening and matching people. So they ask their top psychologist, who reviews every single applicant who comes into NASA, to come up with a system to do this. And for 2 years he tries, and he can't come up with anything. Because the problem is, if you're in the final round of being chosen to be an astronaut for NASA, you're really, really good, right? Like, you have practiced the answer to every question. You've gotten every single thing right in your entire life. You know how to fake emotional intelligence as good as anyone. But the problem is, they couldn't choose people who could fake emotional intelligence, because that would work for a week or maybe two. But when you're in space with someone for 6 months or a year, It can't be faked. It has to be real. It has to be genuine and authentic. So the psychologist, he starts trying to figure out, how do I detect who has real emotional intelligence, who really has skill and talent at connecting with other people from the people who can fake it really, really well? Well, he's listening to some old recordings of interviews that he's done with astronauts when he notices something. The people who they've chosen to be, who ended up becoming great astronauts, and then the people who were chosen to be astronauts who ended up washing out, they weren't good fits. The thing he notices is they answer the questions very similarly, but they laugh really differently. For instance, there's this one candidate who comes in who, after the psychologist comes up with this big insight, the candidate comes in and the psychologist came up with this test. What he would do is when he would walk into the interview room, he would be carrying a big stack of papers and he would be wearing this garish yellow tie. And as soon as he walked into the room, he would accidentally spill the papers, right? It was actually on purpose, but he would spill the papers all over and then he would start laughing at it. And he'd start picking up the papers, and then he would look at the candidate, the person who's waiting to be interviewed, and he would point to his tie, and he's like, you know, I look like a clown today after dropping all these papers. My kid made me wear this, like, ugly tie. And the psychologist would, again, laugh really, really loudly. And what he was looking for, what he was paying attention to, is how did the candidate laugh back? Did the candidate match his basic energy and mood? Or did the candidate do something different? Because everyone knows if someone's laughing, you should laugh back, right? That's basic social, like, politeness. But people who want to connect, people who are talented at connecting, people for whom connecting and emotional intelligence is a value and a high priority, they tend to match our energy and our mood when we communicate non-linguistically. So he goes in, he spills these papers, this candidate, the interviewer starts laughing really loud. The candidate looks at him and he goes, yeah, that's hard. They go on to some other questions. The psychologist starts asking all the interview questions. He gets to a stage where he asks, you know, what's the hardest thing you've ever been through? And the man starts talking about the fact that his father had passed away a few years earlier and how hard that was. And the interviewer, the psychologist, says, oh, my sister passed away and it is so difficult. I think about her all the time. And he talks about his grief. And he asks a couple of questions about the man's father. And the psychologist himself talks a little bit more about his memories of his sister. And then he watches how the candidate responds. And the candidate gives his pat answer. And then he doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't try and match the psychologist, the interviewer's emotional displays. He is not someone who wanted to connect. He was not chosen to become an astronaut. But a couple of months later, when another candidate came in, same thing happened. The man walks in, he spills the paper, he's got the garish tie, he laughs uproariously, and the candidate laughs along with him. And then he asks the question about what's the worst thing that's ever happened to you? And the man says, you know, nothing that bad has really happened to me. I had a friend who passed away about 10 years ago in a car accident. And the psychologist, the interviewer, he says, oh, and he talks about his sister again. And this time what the candidate does, the applicant, is that he starts asking questions. He starts saying to him, you know, what was it like for your mom when your sister passed away? Do you think about her still? Because I still have dreams about my friend who died 10 years ago. Does that ever happen to you with your sister? That man, that was someone who wanted to connect. He was chosen as an astronaut and ended up becoming one of the most successful astronauts in NASA's history. He flew on 5 missions into space. The way that NASA and other groups and us ourselves can show that we want to connect with the others or can determine who wants to connect with us is by sometimes paying attention to their non-linguistic expressions, not the words coming out of their mouth, but how they say them. Do they match our energy? Do they match our mood? Do they ask us questions? And similarly, when they express something emotional, or they express some happiness, or they express some sorrow, or they laugh, we can match them. And in doing so, show them that we want to connect. That's kind of the interesting thing actually about laughter, is that studies show about 80% of laughter does not occur in response to anything humorous, right? I just laughed right now. Most of the time when we laugh, it's not because someone said a joke. Most of the time when we laugh, it's to show the other person that we want to connect with them. And when they laugh back, that's how they show that they want to connect with us. We start to believe that each of us want to connect because we're proving it to each other. And so that's the third idea, is pay attention to someone's mood and energy. See if they match you and match them back in order to connect. The fourth big idea is, how do we prove that we want to connect with someone, right? How do we prove beyond laughing with them or asking questions? How do we prove that we really want to understand them? Because there are some conversations, particularly conversations that happen amid conflict and tension, where it's not enough to ask a question and listen to the other person. What studies show is that in order for us to connect with each other, we have to prove to them that we're listening. We have to prove to them that we want to understand. In the book, there's a story about a big conversation around gun safety that occurred between people who were gun advocates and gun control protesters, activists. This is the kind of conversation, all these people were deeply devoted to their own cause, right? This is the kind of conversation that usually just is totally pointless, because all that happens is that people start screaming to each other or repeating all the talking points they already know. But the organizers of this conversation, they wanted to do something different. They wanted to see if they could get people to talk about these ideas and really understand each other. Not necessarily change anyone's mind, not agree with each other, just understand. And so they taught everyone a specific method for communicating. What they said, and this is called looping for understanding. What they said is, they said, look, what we want you to do is three steps. We want you to ask the other person a question, right? Whatever question you want. And then listen to what they say. And the second step is repeat back in your own words what you just heard them tell you. And then the third step, and this is the step we often forget, but is the most important one, ask them if you got it right. So they give them this training. They say, now, go talk about tough subjects. And people start doing this. And these are people who are usually accustomed to being in fights with each other, not really listening, waiting their turn so that they can say their own thing, not connecting. But because they had these assignments, they had to do this looping for understanding. They had to ask each other questions, listen to what each other said, repeat back in their own words what the person just told them, and then ask them if they got it right. And two things would happen. Number one, sometimes they didn't get it right. Sometimes they didn't really understand what the other person was trying to say. And that was really helpful to know, because nobody was aware that this miscommunication was occurring until they had asked about it. But the second thing is, when someone repeats back your idea to you and then asks you if they got it right, asks you for permission to understand what you're saying, suddenly it feels like we're really heard, like this person wants to understand us. It feels wonderful. And that is how we prove to other people that we want to understand them. That is how we prove to other people that we are really listening, is by looping for understanding, showing them that we're trying to understand, which particularly when we're in a fight with someone or we're talking about a difficult subject or we're talking about politics at the dinner table, and this is a year for politics at the dinner table, or we're talking to one of our kids and they're upset, or we're talking to our spouse and they're angry at us. When we prove that we are trying to understand the other person, when we prove that we are listening, suddenly they trust us more. They like us more. That's hardwired into our brain. And more importantly, they start listening back. They start trying to listen to us because we've so obviously listened to them. So that's the fourth big idea in the book, looping for understanding. There's a method to prove that you're listening. And if you ask questions, repeat back what you heard in your own words, and then most importantly, ask if you got it right, the other person will know that you really want to understand them. Which brings us to our fifth big idea. We've talked a little bit so far about practical conversations, right? The kinds of conversations that we have when we're talking about, say, ideas like gun control. And we've talked a little bit about emotional conversations, about how we show and we transmit emotions and use emotional dialogue to show people that we want to connect with them. Why asking deep questions helps us understand what kind of conversation someone else wants. But we haven't talked that much about the social conversation. Right? And the social conversation is really important because the social conversation is actually the majority of conversations we have. When you talk about friends that you have in common, when you engage in office gossip, when you say something like, you know, I'm going to bring up this idea and I don't know how Jim's going to react to it. Or I got this gift for my wife. What do you think? Do you think she's going to like it? Or, you know, I feel like I feel like they don't listen to me because I don't have the Ivy League degrees that all of them have. Or who are you going to vote for? Or what do you think of that guy? Like, should we be friends with him? Is he a good person? All of those conversations are social conversations. What we're really talking about is we're talking about how we, not as individuals, but as how we as members of a society relate to each other. And one of the most important things about how we relate to each other is that we all have this sense of identity that we carry around with us, right? And these identities are complicated. There's dozens of them. For instance, just take me. I'm a writer, but I'm a dad. I also love to run. I'm a white man who's married to a woman. I live in California. I usually vote for people who are a little bit left of center. I have dozens, thousands of different identities. And when we're having a social conversation, when we're talking about society or how we relate to society or how we relate to other people, what's really important is that we acknowledge those identities in a conversation, right? Think about how frustrating it is when you're talking to someone about a problem or a question and who you are never really comes up. If they're talking about, you know, I think that the police are like are really unfair to minorities. And if you yourself are a police person, or you're a minority, or you're a lawyer, or you're someone who reads about this, the fact that you're who you are shapes how you want to respond. And so you might very well say, look, as a lawyer, I totally hear what you're saying, but I see the good side of cops all the time. I see them help people all the time. And what's really important is that the other person, when you say that, does not deny you that identity. Doesn't say, it doesn't matter if you're a lawyer, you don't really know what you're talking about. Or, you know, as a person who's not a minority, you can't possibly understand this. Because the truth of the matter is that we all have identities. And when we acknowledge those identities, that's when we help each other. That's when we help ourselves communicate. So one of the things that I try and do in social conversations is I always call out other people's perspectives, the person that I'm talking to. I say to them, you know, I see this a little bit differently because I live in California, but I know you live in Texas. Or, you know, I see this a little bit differently because I'm not a gun owner, but I know that you own guns. I know that that's something that's important to you and the Second Amendment is important to you. I know that you grew up in a religious household. I know that you as a woman in science, that you confront different kinds of issues than men in science confront. Or more importantly, I can ask questions and say, as a woman scientist, tell me what that's like. As someone who grew up in a religious household, do you think that shapes your ideas and your feelings on this topic? As someone who is a cop, or as someone who has seen their own kids pulled over unfairly, tell me what that's like. Like, do you think you see this differently than me because of who you are? This is the fifth big idea. Is that oftentimes we want to shy away from our differences. We want to shy away from our identities. But particularly in a social conversation, and many conversations are social conversations, embracing and acknowledging those identities, they help us understand each other. And more importantly, they make us feel safe and secure in that conversation. They make us feel like we have a place in that conversation because the other person has recognized who we are and has supported that, acknowledged that. Every conversation that we have isn't just one thing. Sometimes we'll start on a practical topic and then we'll move to emotional conversation. And then we'll talk about what this means for other people. And it's a social conversation. Then we'll go back to practical. But what's important is learning how to recognize what conversation is occurring and matching each other, inviting others to match us, proving to them that we're listening by asking deep questions and by looping for understanding. Acknowledging who they are so that everyone feels like they have the right to participate in this conversation. They have a place where they can speak up. When we do that, when we try and show someone else that we really want to understand them, that we want to hear them, and most importantly, that we want them to hear us, that is when we start to connect with each other. That's when we become super communicators whenever we need it, whenever we want it. And it's really important and such a useful skill because the right conversation at the right time can change everything. And this is how you have the most meaningful conversations. Thank you so much for spending some time with me. The name of the book is Super Communicators. That's it right over there. And it's out February 20th. I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me at charlesduhigg.com. I actually read and respond to every email I get. And you can also find me online at charlesduhigg.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. That was Charles Duhigg with 5 big ideas from Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Also, check out our book bite for Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way by Jonah Berger. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.